I want to put up on the overhead some of the, by way of review, some of the things that we talked about yesterday with regard to the nature of propositions. And I thought I had them all ready to go here, and now I don't see them. Ah, here we go. Hiding in this pile. Okay, don't pay any attention to the numbers at the top. That's just a page number. Propositions are the meaning of declarative sentences. Only propositions are or can be true or false. I emphasize that words all by themselves are not true. Words without a context. Of course, we use single words in conversation. I gave the example of somebody replying with the word armadillo to the question, what sort of animal is that? But the reply makes sense only because it's an ellipsis. The full proposition is that animal is an armadillo. Words in themselves are not true. Questions are not true or false. They cannot be. Exclamations are and cannot be true or false. And commands are not true or false. At this point, sometimes a Christian will object, what about the Ten Commandments? Aren't they true? And no, they're not true. What is true is if you put the commandment in a proposition such as, God says, thou shalt not kill. And in fact, if you read the account of the commandments in Exodus 20, that's exactly the way it reads. It begins with the introduction, the preamble, explaining who he is and his authority to give these commands, and sets it in the context of a proposition. But the commands in and of themselves, like single words in and of themselves, are not true. The simplest unit of thought is the proposition. The simplest unit of thought is the proposition. Well, continuing here, what is the proposition? Well, it consists of three parts. The logical subject, which is not necessarily the grammatical subject in the sentence. In your grammar, recall, there's subjects and predicates, but the logical subject is not necessarily the grammatical subject. It's the term about which something is said. If we say the home run was hit by Daryl Strawberry, what is the grammatical subject of the sentence? The home run was hit by Daryl Strawberry. Yes, sir? Home run is the grammatical subject. What is the logical subject? Daryl Strawberry is the logical subject. The copula, which is the present tense of the verb to be, is or are. If you can't conjugate the verb to be, go home and practice your conjugation. But the copula is the present tense of the verb to be. That's the second part of a proposition. The third part is the logical predicate, the term which is said about the logical subject. So if we say, and I think I have it here, I can put my fingers on it. Well, I'll just give it to you as an example. It's in a different reference here. All cats are felines. The logical predicate is feline, and the word cat is the logical subject. All cats are felines. And there are any number of examples you want to make up to cover that. Now, continuing with prepositions, another important idea. Did somebody say question? Yes, sir. Part of the subject?
Part of the logical predicate is all cats.
Now, the categorical form applies to the entire proposition, not just the logical subject.
Okay, the entire proposition.
Right. You mean like all or no, or some not? Right, right. Yeah, but they're part of either the subject or the predicate. Okay, the number of English words, and keep this in mind as well, does not necessarily equal the number of terms, logical terms. And I gave two examples. Tastes are different. In this example, the number of English words is the same as the number of logical terms. You have the logical predicate, you have the copula, and you have I'm sorry, the logical subject, the copulant, and the logical predicate. But in the second example, the number is not the same. In colloquial English, dead men tell no tales. In logical form, dead men are not tale tellers or non-tale tellers. And there you have two English words that are the logical subject and three that are the logical predicate. And Clark suggests that when you set these up as in categorical form, you use hyphens or parentheses to indicate, to keep clear in your mind, that this is all one logical term. Now we get to the issue of the categorical forms. Every declarative sentence has to fit one of these forms. All A is B, which we symbolize with the capital A. No A is B, which is a capital E in the symbolism. Some A is B, a capital I. And some A is not B, a capital O. And Clark points out that this choice isn't necessary. I mean, it isn't arbitrary. And it's not based on the vowels of the English language, A-E-I-O-U, but it's based on the vowels that appear in the Latin words, affirmo and nego. A and I and affirmo and E and O and nego. I affirm and I negate or I deny in Latin. And I suggested you take some time and go through the Bible and try to translate some of the propositions in the Bible into categorical form. And why don't we try that? I did a few for you yesterday. Let's try a few more. I'm going to read you a sentence from the Bible and put it into one of these forms, if you would. Okay, I'm using the book of Proverbs. Proverbs 10, verse 1, a wise son makes a glad father. Now, that's not good logical form. It has the verb make in it, not the verb to be. It doesn't say all, some not, or no. So how would you translate a wise son makes a glad father into a logical, one of these categorical forms? Yes, sir, right down here.
Wise son is a glad father maker?
That is very good. What have you left out? Is it some wise sons or all wise sons? Yes, go ahead. All, that's the meaning of the sentence here in Proverbs. All wise sons are glad father makers, not some wise sons. You see how forcing yourself to translate this into categorical form forces you to think about the meaning of it. It doesn't mean just some wise sons. It means all wise sons are glad father makers. Because that's what it means. All wise, a wise son makes a glad father.
And it says there are probably some wise sons who do not make their fathers their glad. Doesn't matter.
You're right, Jeremy. Go ahead.
I would say that it also does not mean that wise sons do not make their glad father.
No. No, it doesn't mean that. I suppose, yes, some people probably have. That's very good. That's very clever. I hadn't even thought of that. That's an understanding that would, it's pretty wild. Do you see what he's saying? Some people might understand that to mean a wise son becomes a glad father. A wise son makes a glad father. But using one verb, the verb to be, and using one of these quantifiers here, indicates the exact meaning of the sentence. It's not no wise sons are glad father makers. It's not some wise sons are glad father makers. It's not some wise sons are not glad father makers. It's only all wise sons are glad father makers. Well, let's continue. A foolish son. Yes, sir. Okay.
Anything in response when you said a wife that may not be sorry, how do you know if you respond to that?
That's not the meaning of the proposition. The meaning of the proposition in English is a wise son, the singular example standing for the whole class of wise sons. All wise sons are glad father makes. It's not talking about a particular wise son. This is an example standing for the whole class of wise sons. That's right. That's right. Okay. Yes, in the back. That's not what the sentences mean. These are not statements that are sometimes true but may sometimes be false.
So how do you deal with
it's a mistranslation.
He will not
depart from the way he is trained up. We don't have our Hebrew expert here. Is Pastor Bordwine around? Okay. Well, the as I understand what you're saying that sometimes the statement is true and sometimes it's not true. And if that's what you're saying, I'd have to disagree vigorously.
Well,
Well, if it's true, it's true. It's not true sometimes and false sometimes. Yes, sir, Jeremy.
And where it says, like, if the lazy man, you know, rolls over and he's dead, and poverty will overtake him, obviously that means all lazy men roll over in the bed, otherwise his poverty will overtake him. But you could roll over in the bed and then hear $1 million, so it's not true all the time, but it's translated. I mean, so where do you say this? I mean, saying the Bible's not, you know, saying it's true.
No, it's a statement about all lazy men, the relationship between laziness and poverty. It's a general statement that applies to all lazy people.
But it's
a general
statement about the lives on this side of poverty.
I'm sorry?
Yeah, it doesn't necessarily follow. What
necessarily follows is poverty from laziness. Did you have something, Linda? Yes, sir. Okay. Well, in any case, let's go on here. Let's translate the second half of this verse into categorical form. A foolish son is the grief of his mother. Now, when it says a foolish son, again, it's an example standing for a whole class, foolish son. The meaning of it in categorical form is all foolish sons are mother grievers. Or if you want to insist on using inclusive language, put in children rather than sons. We're not just talking about sons. But the meaning here is, even though it says A, even though it's singular in English, in the English sentence, it's one example standing for a whole class. How about verse 3 in the same chapter? The Lord will not allow the righteous soul to famish. How would you put that in categorical form? The Lord will not allow the righteous soul to famish or to starve. Yes, sir. Well, we have to have the proper verb. Can you do it with the verb to be? We haven't used the word to be yet. you're using will allow. Oh, I'm sorry. What was the sentence again? Did you say it right? Okay, all righteous souls are those the Lord will not allow to famish. Anybody have a different way of putting it into a categorical form? And you have to hyphenate or put everything after the R in parentheses so you understand that's what the logical term is. Let me see here. A prating fool will fall in verse 8. A prating fool will fall. Yes, sir. All prating fools are fallers. Again, it's a singular example standing for a whole class. How about in chapter 11, a just weight is his delight. A just weight is his delight. Are we talking about one particular weight? When it says A, what's the meaning of it, though, in categorical form? Yes, sir.
All just weights are God's weight.
Okay, all just weights are God's. Not some, not a few, not just one, but all just weights. Weights only?
Yes, weights stand for a class of measurement.
Well, it may, but in this proposition, I think we have to restrict it to weights. Hey, do you get this? I think, pick out a book, pick out a few verses, and do this. We can't do many of them in class, but it will help you understand the Bible if you can translate the English into one of these forms. And if you would continue doing that on your own, let's move on here. Yes, go ahead. Sure, do you have something in mind?
No, but I'd like to go to Bethlehem.
Well, okay. Does anybody have an example from the Bible of something that is not a singular example standing for a class? No, that we're not talking symbolism. I'm sorry? Okay, no sinners will stand before God. There's one that's not A. How would you translate it into categorical form? No sinners will stand before God. Yes, right ahead. No, you. Those who stand before God are not sinners. Is that the meaning of the English? What have we... Go ahead, ma'am.
Well, what if you said no sinners are standing before God?
Okay, you could say it that way. No sinners are standers before God. That's the safe way to do it. The difficulty when you start making conversions is you have to keep in mind exactly what is being said. And we'll explain simple conversion a little bit later on. The safest way to do it is as the lady did it. No sinners are standers before God. Can anybody think of an example with some or some not from the Bible? Well, that's a compound sentence. That's going to make it more complex. Let's take the second half. Few there be who find it. How would you translate that into categorical form? Few there be who find it. Yes, go ahead. Some are narrow wayfinders.
Some are not.
I think that's another implication of the thing. Few there be who find it. Any other questions before we go on and to talk about the next step here? It's very important to do this. Although it may seem tedious, it's important that you understand what the English means before you start drawing inferences from it. And if I can find sheet 5 here. Here we go. That was a good lead-in, a good segue for this one. Some sentences are two or more propositions, and we gave Clark gives this example in the text. All except employees may enter. I'm speaking of the contest. No employees are eligible. All non-employees are eligible. It's a simple English sentence, but two logical propositions. The example the gentleman gave there in the back was a compound English sentence, which entailed two propositions. So keep in mind there that their sentences and propositions are not necessarily equal. Here's a new one from the text. Only freshmen need use the back door. Gave you this one yesterday. All freshmen are required back door users, and all non-freshmen are any door users. The simple English can disguise a great deal of meaning. I hope by Saturday we've reached the point where I can show you exactly how much information can be contained in just a few sentences, and how much, using the rules of inference, you can deduce from just a few propositions. Well, let's proceed then to immediate inference. That's the next step. After propositions, the next step is immediate inference. Immediate inference is an inference in which there are two terms, one premise, one conclusion, and no middle term. And I've given you an example here. All cats are felines. That's the premise. It implies A, all cats are felines, and I, some cats are felines. This is the simplest form of inference. Two terms, cats and felines, in this case. One is a premise, one is a conclusion, no third or no middle term. That's the simplest form of inference. Now, if you have your textbooks, turn to page 34. Clark begins his discussion of immediate inference on that page, and one of the first things he defines is validity. That's a term that we have not defined in so many words so far. Validity. An inference is valid if the form of the conclusion is true every time the forms of the premises are true. Memorize this definition. In his discussion on those pages, he gives you an inaccurate or an incorrect definition to begin with, to make his point that it's the forms that are important. In formal logic, we're talking about the form of the argument, not the content, but the form of the argument. And validity, a valid inference, is one that is in which the form of the conclusion is true every time the forms of the premises are true. Now, if I can find my diagram here, I'll put it up here for you. Okay, this is found, these circles, developed by the, I think he was German or Swiss mathematician Euler, came up with the idea of representing the relationship between subjects and predicates with circles. Now, keep in mind that in the statement, all A is B, and A and B stand for anything you wish. Cats and felines, dogs and canines, whatever it might be. Americans and human beings, all A is B. All Greeks are Athenians, all Vancouverites are Washingtonians. It's the symbolism is unimportant. Just keep in mind that this is somewhat akin to symbolism in algebra. All A is B can have two possible meanings, and that's represented in two diagrams, one of which is that A and B are coextensive. Can anybody give me an example of a all A is B in which A and B are coextensive? Anybody think of an example? Yes. All men are humans. Very good. They're coextensive. A stands for men, and B stands for humans, and they're coextensive. All men are humans. Okay, all mankind. We're using the word inclusively. We're not using it exclusively. Catch up with the times here. Okay. All persons. No, we can't say all persons. We can say, yes, all men are males. That's not quite the... That's right. It's not quite the same. We have to think of where they're coextensive. All, that would be acceptable, I think. All people are human beings. Or all men used as mankind. All mankind are human beings. They're coextensive. And Euler represented this as two circles, one directly on top of the other, and the letters or the symbols A and B appear in the circle. However, the easier case is the A-inclusive case. All cats are felines. Cats being represented by A, and felines being represented by B. B is a bigger class than cats. Now, do you see that? How he's representing these ideas with circles. Clark says this is a very suspicious undertaking here, but since everybody seems to like what's going on and thinks it makes it clear, then he goes on. Now he says, we get to a third case, a third possible relationship between A and B. It's neither coextensive nor A-inclusive, but overlapping. Can anybody think of a situation in which things overlap? Yes. Okay. Now, why did you leave A? Why didn't you use the word all? I said, why didn't you use the word all? That's true. But if you look, and you can't see it very well, if you look at the diagram here, notice the lines underneath. We now have to say either I or O, some or some not. We can no longer say A or all about something. And what was your sentence again? Some males are humans. A is males and B is human. They overlap. They're not coextensive, it's not A inclusive, but they are overlapping. This is the third possible relationship that can exist between these propositions. I'm calling it overlapping. It's a technical term. I don't think Clark names these, but the names I use are coextensive, A-inclusive, overlapping, B-inclusive, and exclusive for the five possible situations. How about this one, this diagram, where you have A including B as a subset or a class within it? Yes. Anybody object to that one? I don't see why not. That's the last possible sum form that you can have there. Some cats are gray. And then finally, the last possible relationship here, and I'll take the paper off altogether, is exclusive. And how would you read that in categorical form? Either A, some not, or no. Which is it? How would you read that? No A is B. Now that exhausts the possible relationships. There are four categorical forms for propositions and five possible relationships. And I think it's found on page 35 or 36 in your book. Now, having this in mind, we're about ready to understand the definition of validity. The definition of validity is an inference is valid if the form of the conclusion is true every time the forms of the premises are true. Okay, suppose we have the conclusion, no cats are felines, and the premise is some cats are felines. Is that a valid argument? Some cats are felines implies no cats are felines. Can you tell from this diagram why? What form is the conclusion is in? No cats are felines. It's E over there. It's the exclusive diagram, the two circles side by side. Remember the definition of validity. To be valid, the form of the conclusion must be true every time the forms of the premises are true. The premise was some cats are felines. Where's that? That's right. It's I of any of the first four. So the form of the conclusion, no cats are felines, is not true every time the form of the premise is true. Some cats are felines, so the argument is invalid. See, we have to concentrate on form. That's why we're moving more and more into using letters rather than words for the arguments. It's the form that's important, the form of the argument. Now, if I were to say, all cats are felines, implies that some cats are not felines. Would that be valid or invalid inference? All cats are felines implies that some cats are not felines. Where's the all cats? Okay, it's false. It's one of these. Where's the some cats are not felines? Oh, one of these. Is the form of the conclusion true every time the form of the premises? It's never true any time the form of the premises. So it's an invalid argument. How about if I say some cats are felines, and this is a mistake people commonly make, implies some cats are not felines. Is that a valid argument or an invalid argument? Does some cats are felines imply that some cats are not felines? Is the form of the conclusion true every time the form of the premise true? It's not. The form of the premise is I. Some cats are felines. The form of the conclusion is O. Some cats are not felines. The form of the conclusion is not true every time the form of the premise is. Some cats are felines does not imply that some cats are not felines. And you have to be very careful when you're reading the Bible or reading any other document or even in ordinary conversation. If someone says to you, and I think Clark uses this example in the text or someone does, some Christians are honest. You have a conversation with an atheist or an unbeliever, and he says, some Christians are honest. He wants you to understand, because he's a poor logician, that some Christians are not honest. But that doesn't follow from his statement. And you should tell him to go take a course in logic. Some Christians are honest does not imply that some Christians are not honest. Not at all. The form of the conclusion is not true every time the form of the premises. The premise is true these four times, and the conclusion is true these three times. The argument is invalid. I does not imply O. Yes?
Your definition, the biggest challenge to reading this, all grass is purple. My yard is made of grass, therefore my yard is purple.
That would be a valid inference.
That's a valid argument.
Mm-hmm.
You know it's not true.
That's right. That logic has nothing to say about the truth of the premises. It has everything to say about the truth of the conclusion. Do you understand that? If you don't, our time's up, I see. But think about that. I does not imply O. And when you come across statements in Scripture or any other document, and you see that some